We are in the second week of our series for this Easter season, thinking all about thinking. It's important because your success in life depends, in large part, upon your thoughts. Your life always moves in the direction of your strongest thoughts. In any area of your life where you're experiencing success, where things are going well, you can trace it back to your thought life. Your success followed good and solid thinking. You gained an insight about a friend, and suddenly the friendship blossomed. You believed in your kids, and they did not disappoint you. You were taught a new habit that improved your outlook and your attitude. Every achievement and success starts with a thought. On the other hand, if there's an area of your life that's not going well, where you're unhappy with the results, then chances are you fell into some faulty thinking along the way. If you have a bad habit or self-defeating behavior, there's probably a limiting belief or a lie you buy that's keeping you from changing that behavior or dropping that habit. The way you think and what you think drive your actions and direct your behavior, in turn, determining outcomes. And your thinking not only determines your actions and outcomes, but impacts the way you feel about life. We often connect feelings to the heart, but our feelings are actually driven much more by our thoughts. We might experience our feelings in our heart, but what causes us to feel in a certain way begins in our mind and how we think. So, if overall you feel good about your life, in your marriage, with your kids, among your friends, about your work or at school, then much of that good feeling comes, at least in part, from your thoughts. However, if you tend to feel depressed, dissatisfied, disgruntled, discouraged with your life, then it might be your thoughts that are leading you to those feelings. The fact of the matter is, you can control your thoughts. You can choose what you think about, what you want to think about. And as we think differently, our brain physically changes. All of this is nothing new. Scientific research has finally caught up with Scripture. Throughout the Bible, we're taught to pay attention to our thoughts, that if we want to head in the right direction and find the success we seek, we have to learn to think correctly. In his letter to the Romans, St. Paul famously wrote, "Do not be conformed to this world, but be transformed by the renewal of your mind." The renewal of your mind. Today we're going to look at the first and maybe most important mental move we can make to renew our minds and set ourselves up for success. And it's simply this: replace the lies we believe with truth. Replace the lies we believe with truth. But not just any lies. Replace the lies we believe about ourselves. Believing a lie about anything can be restricting, bringing so much unnecessary hurt and harm and even heartache into our lives. Setting our mind on things that are not true or only partly true stunts our growth and maturity. It can hold us back from success. Believing a lie about anything can be restricting, but believing a lie about yourself is worse. It's far worse. A lie about yourself, believed as truth, will affect every area of your life. It will imprison you and keep you from your full potential, as well as your full ability to love God and love others. On the other hand, as Jesus himself taught us, the truth will set you free. Free your mind from lies you believe, and the rest of your life will follow. Now, there are many lies we can be tempted to believe about ourselves, but today we're going to look at the number one lie at the heart of all the other lies. If we can learn to spot this lie in its various manifestations and replace it with the truth, then we'll be well on our way to the renewal of our mind. To help us get started, we're going to look at a passage from the Gospel of John, a passage we always read on this second Sunday of Easter. John tells us, "On the evening of that first day of the week, when the disciples were together with the doors locked for fear of the Jews, Jesus came and stood in their midst and said to them, 'Peace be with you.'" So you know the story. The scene is Easter Sunday night. Two of the apostles, John and Peter, had already gone to Jesus' tomb and found it empty. However, they didn't know what to make of the situation. They knew that Jesus was crucified and laid in the tomb, and suddenly the tomb is empty. Some women from their group claimed that they had seen Jesus alive, but that didn't make any sense. Here's what they did know. Their leader had died. All but one of them abandoned him in his time of need. Judas betrayed him. Peter denied him. The others fled in fear for their lives. And they had no real plan for the future because riding Jesus' coattails had been their plan. So they huddled together, paralyzed with fear, their thoughts fixed on the very worst kind of negative thinking. Because, I mean, if you're hiding from people you think are actively trying to kill you, that's about as negative as it gets. Little wonder, then, that Jesus' first words to them would be simply, "Peace be with you." That's Jesus' overriding response to all our negative thinking. Peace be with you. He calms their negative thinking, and then look what he does next. When he had said this, he showed them his hands and his side. The disciples rejoiced when they saw the Lord. It's really him. He's really alive. He was really dead, and now he's really alive. He's helping them change their minds. The passage continues. Thomas, one of the 12, was not with them when Jesus came. So the other disciples said to him, "We have seen the Lord." But he said to them, "Unless I see the mark of the nails in his hands and put my finger into the nail marks and put my hand into his side, I will not believe." Poor Thomas, he's called the doubter. And he's remembered every single Easter as the doubting Thomas. Poor Thomas. But consider this. He's not doubting Jesus. He's doubting the other apostles. He doesn't trust his friends. And he demands even more evidence than they received. They saw Jesus' wounds. But he demands to touch them and probe them, a demand revealing deep, dark skepticism. Buried in his own thinking, he's convinced that Jesus is dead until a week later. The disciples were again inside, and Thomas was with them. Jesus came, although the doors were locked, and stood in their midst and said to them, "Peace be with you." Then he said to Thomas, "Put your finger here and see my hands, and bring your hand and put it into my side, and do not be unbelieving, but believe." Do not be unbelieving, but believe. Those final words, they apply to all of us, to everyone here today, myself included. Whoever you are, wherever you are in your faith journey, the message is the same. Do not be unbelieving. You know, we will absolutely experience doubt, but as people of faith, we do not live our lives in doubt. We will experience fear, but as people of faith, we do not live our lives in fear. We will absolutely, positively experience unbelief, but as people of faith, we do not live our lives in unbelief. Every time we allow ourselves to dwell in fear, to linger in worry, to settle down into anger, to live in doubt, we reinforce those negative thoughts in our mind. And soon, they become easier and easier to go to, our habitual reactions. We train ourselves to think those negative thoughts, and they come to frame our perspective on life. So Jesus says to Thomas, and he says to you and me, do not be unbelieving, but believe. Be a believer. Choose to embrace the reality that God is greater than your doubt. God is greater than your fears. God is greater than your unbelief. Choose to believe that God is greater than anything, including the great big lie we buy. The great big lie we buy that's ultimately behind 95, if not 100% of our living in a state of worry or confusion or shame or despair or doubt or fear or unbelief and all the rest. The great big lie is this: sin and death have the last word. That's it. Sin and death have the last word. That's the lie we buy, or at least the lie behind all the other lies we buy. My sin defines who I am. My inevitable death defines who I will be. That lie drives all our doubts, fuels our fears, and is directly linked to our unbelief. Don't believe me? Think about it. You failed at work or school or on your team, and you let that failure define you. You're a failure. There was hurt and heartache in your marriage, so you're done with relationships. You're unlovable. You've fallen back into debt, even though you promised yourself you would never do that again. You're a loser. You've done some things you're ashamed of, and you're sure God is mad at you. You're a disgrace. Those are lies. In all those scenarios, we believe a lie that our sin or our faults and failures that feel like death have the last word. The lie we buy is that they define us. But the resurrection dispels that lie. Jesus' victory over sin and death is our victory over sin and death. Because he rose from the dead, we can too. And while that certainly means that there's life after death, it also means, despite our faults and failures, we can succeed in living in victory right now. Like our risen Savior, we all bear scars from this life. Our wounds are part of our story, and we will be wounded again. But those wounds are not the whole of our story. They're part of our story, but they're not the whole of our story. The other part, the powerful part, the important part, is the resurrection of Jesus Christ. If you think about it, Thomas is anything but a doubter. He doesn't doubt for a moment that Jesus is dead. The lie he buys is the same one we do too. Death cannot be overcome. Death has the final word. Jesus finally and at last challenges Thomas to give up the lie, to change his mind. To change our mind, to renew our minds, we have to get better at recognizing when we're lying to ourselves. Why not try this simple process? First, identify a negative feeling or emotion that you've been feeling that has become habitual. Fear, frustration, anger, confusion, doubt. The experience of any of those emotions is a normal part of life, but when they become habitual, it means we're believing the lie. It means we're living the lie. Second, identify the lie behind the lie. What am I believing that's leading to that emotion? In what sense does it refer back to sin or death? And third, raise up the lie in prayer, specifically calling on the power of Jesus Christ's resurrection. By the way, if you'd like help with that this week, sign up for our daily devotional. You can do so by texting prayer to 88877. That's prayer to 88877. It'll be our daily gift to you. You know, you can control your thoughts. And here's the thing. Faith can be a powerful factor in that control. Think about it.